Welcome back to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm your host, Graham Richmond, and this is your Wiretaps podcast for January 13th, 2020. Alex Brown joins me, as always, for Wiretaps. Alex, how are things going?
Very good. Thank you, Graham.
Good. So our sponsor for this podcast is the Evening and Weekend Program at the Kellogg School of Management. We're thrilled to have them as a sponsor. Alex, last week was a big week. I think there were over 25 deadlines for what we would call kind of round two, in most cases, admissions. And so I think, you know, people are breathing maybe a bit of a sigh of relief, but what's on tap for this week? Because I think we're not quite done with the deadlines.
Yeah, we're not quite done. As you mentioned, most schools, you know, they like to do that round two deadline right after the sort of late December, January break. And a lot of schools did do it last week. Upcoming, we have a couple of deadlines. I mean, MIT Sloan, I think the smartest of the top schools, they're waiting not even this week till next week. So those folks might have recovered from some of their round two applications and then think, you know what, I got one more to go and I can just focus on the Sloan deadline at that point. But I think this week we've got a few European deadlines also and Stern in the hopper. So a little bit more activity, but yeah, last week was a huge, huge week for round two candidates.
Yes. And due to a couple of things happening, I actually felt inspired to publish a piece on LinkedIn about what I would call deadline congestion. And as you pointed out, you know, all the schools sit right there after the holidays in that first week back at the office, presumably because they want to get their reading started and the admissions process, you know, off to the races. But, you know, I think MIT is looking pretty smart sitting there in kind of mid to late January, where there's like sort of no other deadlines around them and people have plenty of time to work on this stuff. You have to remember recommendation writers, and it's, you know, there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle of getting an application in. So, and actually, I think we're seeing some fallout from this deadline congestion in the shape of maybe fewer applications to some schools who, you know, had their deadlines right in the thick of it and maybe wondered if they should have extended. So what was, you actually got word of a couple of schools extending their round two deadlines?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like Georgetown and USC, two programs, you know, they're in the top 20, very good programs. It looks like they've extended their deadline, maybe only a few days.
Yeah, I think it's about a week in both cases, yeah.
You know, when schools do that, they run into some very gray and murky water, from my perspective. Because when I was at Wharton, I always thought whenever you make a decision that changes the goalposts or the playing field or whatever you want to call it, I extend around, you have to think, how does that affect all candidates applying in that round, not simply those that are seeking an extension? So what about the candidate that really had to scramble to get that application in under the deadline and was successful in doing so, but having done so, that candidate might have compromised a little bit. Maybe they rushed their recommender. Maybe they rushed some aspect of the application in order to do what they thought they had to do to follow the rules of the game. So this extension stuff, I think, is quite tricky for schools.
Yeah, and I mean, just so our listeners understand, I mean, it's not as though these schools went on their website and publicly said, hey, our deadline's been changed. They literally just kind of emailed folks in their CRM who had maybe started an application or opened an account who had not ultimately applied. And they, you know, in the case of USC, they sort of passed it off as, oh, we've gotten a lot of requests for extensions, and so we're extending the deadline. Having been in this industry for many, many years, the first thought I had was they maybe didn't get as many applications as they had wanted in the second round. Obviously, I don't know. We could check in with them, and our editor in chief will probably be looking into that. But I agree with you, Alex. What about all the people who already submitted? Are they reaching out to them to say, hey, you know what, if you want to get us anything extra or you know, hit the reset on something, we're not looking at your files until date X. I'm not sure that's what's happening here, though. So I think the playing field may be a little tilted, as you point out, Alex. The other thing we've seen on Livewire, and then we'll get into our usual Wiretaps candidate breakdowns here, but is you saw something interesting with, I guess, is it Arizona State? that's got something going on that you spotted in Livewire.
Yeah, I mean, I just saw this late last week. It looks like they've been doing some searches on GMAT, so I guess getting GMAT scores from GMAS or however the industry does this these days, and seeking out candidates with potential financial aid offers prior to them actually applying. Now, we know that Carey has a really cool scholarship program for all its candidates, so they are typically very generous. But to make that offer before a candidate has even submitted an application is definitely a bold step. One could qualify it as a bold step. Others might have a different interpretation. But these are definitely interesting times, Graham, in terms of these programs, maybe in the top 20, top 30, top 40, really seeking out candidates when potentially their applicant pools are shrinking. And I would suggest that, you know, schools at that level in the sort of the rankings orders, that then manifests into smaller class sizes, which can impact the learning environment and the value propositions offered by these schools. So it's very important that they keep these class sizes.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I think the person who posted this said they are currently waitlisted at a handful of schools, and they got an email out of the blue saying that they're offered not only full tuition, but admission pending an interview, right? So, interesting tactic that I have not seen before. Clearly, you know, and as you guessed, they're probably mining the, you know, GMAC offers the database up to schools if they want to mine that database, find people with high scores and make them offers. Just an interesting strategy. So, yeah, we will see. These are lean times for top schools, which means it's a great time to apply. And, you know, we've got a lot of data, as everyone knows, at ClearAdmit, and we're looking at that data. We're going to have some interesting news forthcoming when it comes to, you know, how are things shaking out this year in terms of offers people are getting and, you know, scholarship dollars, all that stuff. So stay tuned there. Alex, let's move into the wiretaps portion. You've picked out a few profiles, a couple of ApplyWire and one DecisionWire entry that we're going to go through. Before I do that, I just wanted to remind everyone that, you know, you can reach your highest career goals while earning an MBA part-time. And the evening and weekend MBA program at the Kellogg School of Management, which is located in downtown Chicago, offers flexible study options to fit your lifestyle and match your experience. And by graduation, you'll share the same toolkit, skills, and network as the school's most prominent alumni. So visit kellogg.northwestern.edu/EW to learn more. And again, we're so happy to have Kellogg as a sponsor for this podcast. Alex, you have gone about picking out a handful, and these are really interesting this week. So if you're ready, I think we should just dive on in.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's look at Wiretaps candidate number one. So this is an ApplyWire entry that we received, and this person is applying to Tuck, Kelly, Rochester, and UVA Darden. They would like to start business school in the fall, and they've been working in marketing. They actually gave us a little more specifics. I think they've been working with a kind of marketing at a glass replacement company. So something, you know, more on the consumer side, not something we'd see that often, I guess. They want to get into consumer goods post MBA, kind of CPG type work, and the companies that they're thinking of are 3M, Nike, and some others. So GMAT score 740, GPA 3.6. They've been working for 6 years, and they're located in Oregon. And Alex, I think this is like a classic case of where maybe an ApplyWire entry, at least the basic stats, don't capture everything, because you kind of and I both had some engagement with this applicant on the site, in which we kind of asked questions and sort of said, gee, maybe you're not even high enough kind of stuff. And then what happened after that? Because you had a dialogue with them afterwards.
Sure. I mean, yeah, our first reaction based on the profile posted was potentially the candidate could be applying to maybe a couple of M7 programs. Kellogg comes to mind. You know, they want marketing, they've got a 740 GMAT, 361 GPA, 6 years of experience. It just sounds like the basics of a really strong profile. then the candidate revealed that actually they've had some interruptions, as it were, in the past. The candidates, and I'll quote, "I was addicted to heroin for years, went to jail for 2 years. I've been sober for 5 years and work in a leadership and marketing role at a glass replacement company," so we know that. ECs, extracurriculars, are all helping recovering addicts and marketing. I even went back to jail as a guest speaker recently. Not sure if I'll get anywhere based on this past. So clearly, Graham, this is the elephant in the room. Not only, you know, this person's been to jail. So how does ACOM deal with this? So what are your initial thoughts to this situation, Graham?
You know, I'm split. I got to be honest, because when you pointed this post out to me, I instantly fired off a couple of emails to admissions folks, and I haven't heard back. You know, it's kind of waiting to hear what people think about this in the industry. But my initial thought was, you know, on the one hand, the numbers are really good, and this candidate, I mean, you know, they've overcome something that most of us don't ever have to deal with, which is addiction to, you know, a hard drug, and they've been in jail. I mean, then they've overcome that, and they're also actually doing all these extracurriculars around helping recovering addicts. And it's been, you know, 5 years now that they've been sober, I think. So there are things to like. I mean, I think it's admirable, like what they've, you know, overcome, and even going back to the jail to speak. So I think there's a real kind of a human interest story here. The fear that I have is, you know, does an admissions team want to take this risk, right? Because I think, you know, it's a good feel-good story until it's not, like if there's a relapse or something, right? So it's really, I'm on the fence. I mean, I think on the one hand, maybe I'm getting too nitpicky here, but my first thought was, well, what were they in jail for? Is it like, you know, were they like stealing stuff to get money for drugs, or is it like something more violent or dangerous, right? So that came to my mind as well, because it's one thing to say you've had a substance abuse problem and have overcome it and been in treatment and have had a successful career since and your numbers are great, but the jail piece sort of adds this other, you know, complexity to it. So I don't know, what was your take? Like, do you think this person, you know, gets a second chance, you know, by getting into one of these programs, and or maybe it varies depending on the program. I don't know how you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a case of applying to several schools to hope that at least one of the programs does take that point of view. I do like the fact that the person has gone back to jail as a guest speaker. I do like the fact that they work proactively helping recovering addicts. So if they weren't involved in that type of extracurricular activity, I think there's no chance. In my mind. But being involved in those types of activities really shows that, you know, they recognize, obviously, they've recognized their missteps. I mean, that would be ridiculous not to say that. But to actually then actively involve themselves in helping others that are either going down the path to face the same situations or have faced the same situations. So that all plays very positively, I think. And yeah, this is an interesting human interest story. Like you say, the reason for going to jail is going to be quite important, I think.
Yeah. I also want to know the timeline.
You know, they've served their time, right?
Yeah, they do, yeah.
That's the reason people go to jail, is to serve their time. So they should get a little bit of a pass for that. And I also wonder what activities, assuming there are activities that the person can be involved in during that 2 year period, because the other thing that ADCOM always looks at is if you're not in work, you know, if you have a gap in work, an employment gap or something, it'll be like, well, what did you do during that time? Well, you say, well, I was in jail, and that's why I wasn't
right,
in
that
work.
Doesn't work. They might have been studying for the GMAT because they have a really good score. So that could have been, yeah.
There are things that someone can do during that time,
yes,
in jail,
no, right,
to improve themselves.
Of course. I want to know the timeline, though. Like, they indicate 6 years of work experience. So I'm kind of, but I'm trying to do the math here and figure out, like, when did the heroin addiction happen? Was it in school, like in college? But then they had a 3-6, so maybe not. So maybe it was after. But so I'm just trying to figure out, like, is this person like 35? Are they 28? Like, I don't have any sense for that because there's some lost time due to addiction and being in jail or whatever. So, again, if I had to put money on this kind of thing, I would say it's probably more likely that a lower ranking program will take a risk on, looking at the sort of human interest side of this and the 740-36 that'll really help their student body profile, than it is that a top school would take the risk. That's my guess. You never know, though.
The other side of that, though, is, Graham, and you mentioned this earlier, is they've overcome a very poor situation. So in that respect, they've come far, and they're helping people that are going down that wrong path. So I do think there's value there, just as much as there's value there when, someone's, let's say, first generation college or has issues. We've talked about candidates that maybe had issues prior to going to college and that distracted them from their college studies or whatever it was. Obviously, this is a very different situation, but nevertheless, they've overcome a very, very significant setback.
Obviously, I think in an ideal world, this person would be given a second chance. And on the other hand, like, you could also say that what they've done and what's happened to them doesn't show up in any, kind of statistics that schools are being ranked by or anything. So a school could very easily take a risk on someone like this, right? I mean, it's not like it's disclosed in, in U.S. news or something. It's just going to depend on the readers that see this file and on the candidate's ability to tell this story in a compelling way.
And maybe, Graham, strong, super strong recs. That's probably going to be quite important in this case. So having that third party reference point where the boss can say, and be very blunt about how much this candidate has overcome and how strong they are now. And so on and so forth. So maybe the recs become really important in this case.
Yeah. So anyway, Alex, I think both of us are kind of rooting for this person, and hopefully they'll keep us posted as to how it goes. And yeah, congratulations to them for being sober for 5 years. I know, heroin's supposed to be the most addictive drug known to mankind, right? So it's a big hurdle.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I've been around addiction, but alcohol addiction, not heroin addiction. And I know how debilitating it is. So best of luck to this guy.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on and talk about Wiretap's candidate number two. So this is another Apply Wire entry. This person is looking at Berkeley, Michigan Ross, UNC, and Yale SOM. And they've been working at a hedge fund. They want to start school next fall. And they're hoping to actually pivot over into consulting. The GRE score is a 324. The GPA 3.23, and they have 5 years of work experience. They would love to stay in the Northeast after business school. That's where they currently are located. And it turns out that they applied to a bunch of schools in round one, which included, Duke, Tuck, Darden, UCLA, and Cornell. And as of now, they are 0-4, and they have an interview pending at Johnson. So they have not made it through in round one, and that's where these additional applications in round two are coming from. And they're kind of trying to figure out like what went wrong. And they did mention the breakdown on the GRE is a 164 verbal and a 160 quant. They've taken it twice though, and the other time they had a 160 verbal and a 164 quant. So Alex, what's your take on this candidate? And I think you maybe explain why you picked this person, because I think it is instructive.
Sure. I mean, the reason why I picked this person is I think a lot of candidates at this stage of the application process are going through this evolution of, the results are in round one, now heading off into round two. How do I look? This, that, and the other. And obviously for some candidates, the results coming out of round one haven't been and what they'd hoped for. And this is a case in point in that regard, I think. So they've applied, like you said, to Duke, Tuck, where they interviewed at both of those programs, but they're self-initiated interviews. They got an interview invite, or they interviewed at Anderson and weren't successful. They didn't get an invite at Darden. And they have a forthcoming interview at Johnson. So they're still in the running for round one, or I don't know if that's a round two for Johnson, but it's an earlier round for Johnson anyway. They're still in the running there. And, you know, my first blush at that sort of success is actually, you know, if you don't get an invite at Darden, you get an invite at Anderson Johnson, that kind of makes a little bit of sense to me. Tuck and Duke, self-initiated, so you don't know if you would have been invited. But nevertheless, you know, they're obviously stressing a little bit about that, wondering if it's their interview skills that are not performing well for them. But I don't think that's going to be the case, because frankly, interviewing is just about, you know, being confident in your application. You know, most of these are, I think all of these were blind interviews, so there shouldn't be too much trickery involved in performing well in those interviews. So, yeah, it's tricky. They're applying now to Yale, Haas and Ross. So they don't feel that they've got much of a chance simply because Yale, Haas and Ross are similarly competitive to the schools that they weren't successful with in round one. I guess that's their issue here.
Well, they also added UNC, which I guess they're probably, but they mentioned specifically they're not expecting much from Yale, Haas and Ross. Yeah.
I would go into the applications trying to think that you're expecting something. So it could affect, I guess, in your presentation if you're sort of feeling pretty down about it. But the reality is, and I'm sure this candidate recognizes this, there is a learning curve to this process. So I would suggest that just by going through round one, that these applications to Yale, Haas and Ross and potentially Keenan Flagler are actually stronger applications than the first set of applications they put in. This doesn't happen for everybody, but time and time again, I hear from candidates that say, well, I applied in round two, and by that point, I really understood my application and so on and so forth, so I had a stronger application. So I guess I'm saying all this to say, don't dismiss the fact that you might actually be more successful in round two than you were in round one at the same sort of caliber of program. Obviously, the GRE is a bit frustrating for this candidate. They tend to perform well on one side versus the other, or the other side versus one side. I don't really have an answer for that, other than, you know, the overall GRE score is pretty decent anyway, and the component scores are above, or 160 and above, so I think that's not going to be the reason why they're not particularly successful in round one. Their GPA is a little bit lower than average, 3.23, but again, it's not really a disqualifier. Obviously, the combination, the better the test score, the better off they'll be. So if they do ultimately end up reapplying next year to see if they can bang that up a few points, probably would be a smart thing to try to do. They're working in hedge funds, Graham, planning to transition into consulting. We don't know a lot about that, right? On the one hand, hedge fund work experience could be very strong. On the other hand, it might not be so strong, right, Graham? I mean, we really need to know a bit more about that to assess that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I have a theory on this candidate, which I'll share, and that is that, you know, so there's no one thing that, like, leaps off the page as being, like, something that would sink the ship. But, you know, they are, as you point out, like, the GRE 324, it's a respectable score. You know, even the splits you talked about, I mean, they've bested at 94th percentile on verbal, and in the other exam when they had a higher quant, they had an 84th percentile on quant. So it's not bad. I mean, these are good scores. GPA a little low, right, like you're saying. But I think what stands out to me and what I'm kind of just ruminating on is, you know, is this sort of like Joe White guy working at a hedge fund in the northeast of the U.S. with kind of numbers that are below average at a lot of their target schools, telling a story of moving into a very common field for MBA applicants? And so did this person have trouble standing out? You know, what are the kind of, like, how strong were the ECs? I mean, it sounds like they have some. They do some, you know, athletic stuff in the athletics, and they raise money for charities. But I just wondered if this person really, you know, was able to jump off the page much, and whether they had a good story for making this move from a hedge fund into consulting, especially, you know, I mean, I can just picture they probably mentioned they want to work at McKinsey, Bain, BCG or something, which is really common. So you need to kind of, what's the differentiation? Has their hedge fund been focused on a specific sector that they're really passionate about? And they know that consulting firms A, B, and C do a lot of work in that domain. They want to do that and then go and start their own company or work for a company in that domain. Like, where's the story? And maybe it is there. I want to disagree with you about interviewing. I mean, I do agree on the sense in the sense that a blind resume-based interview shouldn't be too hard. But I think some candidates are better than others at just telling their story in person. And maybe that is an area that this person needs to work on if they are fortunate to get invited at, you know, any of the programs they're currently applying to, or as they prep for the Cornell interview. I mean, we have a whole archive of questions. We always recommend that people practice as much as they can with friends, family, whoever will listen. And so, yeah, I just think this person is probably, if I were to look at their file, or see could be a fly on the wall with their interviews, I'm guessing that there would be some things that would jump right off the page, or, you know, right off the experience at me, that you know, that we could give them advice on how to do this in a more effective way. But as you say, you know, the round two applications are hopefully stronger. Although I have seen instances where candidates kind of they strike out in round one, and then they just kind of throw together the same old materials and rush them in to round two when they realize they need to kind of take another swing at things. And so I think it'll depend on how much time they put into those applications in round two.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And your point for the interviews is very fair. I shouldn't be dismissive about the importance of performing well in the interview. But I guess my point is more, you know, ADCOM, you know, they'll look at the interview reports in context of everything else and then make a final decision. It won't be that perhaps the interview was a bit ho-hum and that clearly eliminates a candidate. And it seems to me in this case, they didn't say I did dreadfully in the interviews, which oftentimes you'll see that from a candidate who knows that they did dreadfully in an interview. So, but yeah, I mean, hopefully they're still in the running at Johnson. They've got an interview invite. They interview well at Johnson, make good sense of it. They're all done and dusted. Not only would they then get the offer at Johnson, they might still have some opportunities at some other schools. So it's not all doom and gloom, but if they have to come back next season, you know, again, with the learning curve, they'll come back stronger.
Yeah, and I'd love to know more about this candidate too. I mean, you know, we're making a lot of kind of, we have to make some guesses based on the data we have here. I mean, I'd love to know, I mean, I don't know, maybe they're a chemical engineering undergrad at like a top school, you know, or something. So what's the context for the 3-2? Yeah, so you just need to know more. In any event, best of luck to them. Hopefully, yeah, I would really prep hard for the Cornell interview. It's a great school, Ivy League, really beautiful campus. And so they, you know, just get into the mindset of Cornell, do well on that interview, and then we'll see what happens in round two for them too. So let's move on and talk about Wiretap's candidate number three. So this is a DecisionWire entry from a candidate who has had a lot of good news so far, but is undecided about where to go. This person was admitted to Tuck with a $30,000 scholarship. They were admitted to MIT with no money. They were admitted to Kellogg with $120,000, UT Austin McCombs with $114,000, and they were also accepted at Darden with $100,000. And, you know, they want to start, obviously they're starting next fall, they want to work in tech. GMAT score was 760. This is a U.S. candidate, and, you know, they are really struggling with this decision, and they basically said, you know, they would be happy to attend all these schools and they're open to all U.S. locations, but they mention it's hard to look past a Sloan admit for a tech career goal. And they love Tuck's feel, but it seems like the answer might be to just take the Kellogg money and run. So what they wanted to know our advice, and they also included a little extra nugget of information, which was that they also applied to Wharton and are currently on the wait list there, and wondered if that matters in the calculus of this decision. So people have chimed in beyond us. We have there's actually a person who writes quite a bit on the site. You know, their handle is anonymous 30922, but they've been leaving a lot of great comments. So a number of people have commented on this, and it seems like, you know, some people are like, oh, go to Sloan, you know, and then other people are questioning that a little bit. So what's your take here? What should this person do?
Well, very, very interesting and very successful. So congratulations to this candidate. Obviously, the Kellogg Financial Aid Award is extremely tempting, I think. And I know you're a fan of the Kellogg Choice, because we talked about this before coming on air. To take that kind of money, and Kellogg is actually, does some really cool things in tech, has its new building and so on and so forth. And I'll let you go on about that here in a minute. Obviously, the Sloan has the tech reputation and the brand for tech and so forth. And they have a, they're that sort of swaying them back to Sloan. So one of the things they should be doing or could consider doing, and this was proposed by one of the candidates that also responded, they said same position and went with Sloan, leveraged scholarships somewhere else, i.e. they got a scholarship at another school, and got a partial match at Sloan. It said, but not guaranteed, not sure what that means. I guess, and then they went on, depends how much Sloan wants you. Certainly, it makes sense to see if Sloan would be open to offering a scholarship based on the Kellogg offer. That's a very generous offer, obviously, from Kellogg. So that might be a way to go. I also think it just makes sense at this juncture, if the candidate hasn't made a final decision, to keep their options open by committing to the Wharton waitlist. If they thought that there was a scenario where they would turn down the Kellogg money to go to Wharton, or the Sloan option to go to Wharton. And I think, for some people, absolutely they would do that. For some other folks, perhaps not. But, the candidate has some terrific options. Someone else suggested that they please withdraw from McCombs straight away so that they can get a spot at McCombs or negotiate scholarship at McCombs. And certainly, I think that person raises a good point. If you have several offers and you know that one or two of those offers you're not going to accept at this stage, it helps other candidates in the process if you withdraw your candidacy from those offers. I think it just helps everybody, the schools themselves, as well as other candidates. So that would be a good thing to do. But I know you like the Kellogg offer in this, Graham, so I'll let you talk to that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this person should go where they feel most comfortable, and I think, but the issue that I see is one of, we talk a lot about these tiers of schools, and I think most people would argue that MIT and Kellogg are in the same kind of, at least the M7 group, and arguably some people would say, oh, the M7 group has kind of Harvard and Stanford and maybe Wharton and then the other four, but whatever the case, they're in a similar group, and so you're looking at one school that's given you zero in terms of financial aid, and the other has, it's not like Kellogg's giving them like 20 grand, which would be, not worth kind of making the decision around given the salaries people get after business school. I mean, Kellogg's offering them $120,000, which is a really big scholarship, which not only helps them to pay, to defray the cost of going off to business school, but it's something that you put on your resume, that you got a full, basically what I think must amount to a near full or three-fourths scholarship to attend the program. So that has its own things. And the other thing I was just thinking about is I'm like, Kellogg is, as you mentioned, they have this great new facilities, as does, MIT Sloan has a very new building too. So they both have really great kind of student experiences. But I would just tell this person to go to the welcome events and spend time on campus and see which culture you feel you fit into more, because they're really different. Culturally, they're just different schools. And so I would just say, at least give Kellogg a chance and go to their welcome event, see what you think of the place. Because quite frankly, if this person wants to work at a major tech company, they can get that job from either of those programs. I think if they're thinking of sort of starting their own tech company and want to incubate it while in school, then you start to get into, well, maybe it's nice to have MIT engineers around to kind of work with, or, there's that whole other ecosystem that exists at MIT, from the media lab to, it's just a really rich ecosystem. So I think they need to explore this and go to the schools and find out more if they can. And I agree, if they feel like a Wharton admit would be better than the MIT admit, then yeah, they should play the waitlist out and see where that goes. But yeah, that's my take. Again, this isn't easy. And, you know, it's obviously a great problem to have, to have all this money on the table and to be making this decision. But yeah, I just wanted to make sure they're not too quickly looking past, because I think, you know, Kellogg has done pretty well with tech placement in recent years. So I wouldn't dismiss them out of hand.
No, I completely agree. And I think your insight, you know, in terms of looking at whether they're looking directly at tech entrepreneurship or tech with a big, these, you know, vibe, you know, bigger tech firms, does, you know, help nuance that decision a little bit. Because clearly the MIT resources for entrepreneurship are outstanding.
And also, I mean, what do they want to do in tech? Like, do they want to be working in marketing at Apple or something? Like, well, that might mean that Kellogg even might have an advantage, you know, in a domain like that, right? Or do they want to be doing like product management for IBM or something? Well, then, okay, you know, maybe, you know, so I think they need to figure that part out, ideally.
Well, they probably have. They just didn't express it with us, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So a really interesting case, though, and I think ultimately, as candidates face these decisions, which are great problems to have, they make the final decision and then never look back. They will be successful. It'll be fantastic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I have a little surprise that we've kind of tucked in at the back end of the podcast to just reward those of you who actually listen to the end. Think of this as like the bonus, you know, the hidden track at the end of the Nirvana record or whatever, right? So we've actually, I mean, ClearAdmit is always looking for new ways to support MBA applicants. Like, so for example, we recently added this like sort by GMAT GRE function on the wires based on some Reddit comments that we'd gotten from candidates who wanted more ways to interact with our data. And we actually recently launched a kind of private user advisory group to get input directly from business school applicants as we kind of brainstorm and prioritize new features for the site. So, and you know, it turns out that this little group that we've created also provides a space for applicants, you know, for our listeners really to connect with each other on a more personal level. You know, we've actually enjoyed interacting with some candidates and learning more about them. And so basically we've created this thing called the ClearAdmit Boardroom. And if you are interested and you're listening to this podcast and want to join the boardroom, we'd love to have you. All you have to do is visit bit.ly/ClearAdmit Boardroom. And you can find out more. You can fill out a brief survey. The group is hosted on Facebook, so you do need a Facebook account in order to join the group. And again, it's just bit.ly, which is bit.ly/ClearAdmit Boardroom, all one word. And I just appreciate you considering this. If you're a regular listener of our podcast and a regular user of the site, we'd love to see you in the ClearAdmit Boardroom. So check it out. And yeah, thanks everyone for listening. Alex, as always, thanks for picking out these wire entries for us to review. And we'll be back in 1 week's time to do this all over again.
Very good. Thanks a lot, Graham. Take care.
All right. Take care, everyone.